Welcome to the Lead Lifestyle podcast, where we believe every person can achieve their life goals as a result of their work, not in spite of it. We interview the best minds in the world so you can learn their philosophy, daily routines, and everything in between so you can optimize your lifestyle, reach peak physical health, and influence your team into high performance. So my guest today is Tony Summers. Tony is a self-defense instructor. He's an expert in life coaching and a professional counselor as well. He's worked 17 years as a firefighter with the West Midlands Fire Service, and he's got extensive experience practicing and teaching martial arts as well. So Tony's an expert on transforming people through improved self-confidence. So thanks for coming on, Tom.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me, Anthony.
Hey, it's going to be a good conversation. So before we kind of went live with this, we were talking about where we could go and what we could talk about. And I think a topic that's come up again and again in conversations I've had with business owners, leaders, is that mental health in the workplace is becoming more of a trendy thing to talk about, but often people are just paying it lip service instead of actually having a practical thing or a resource they can actually give to their staff. I know that a few of my friends are struggling with their managers saying, you know, it's all the cliches of it's okay not to be okay and everything else, but there's nothing they're actually doing in terms of the substance to help people. So what are some good practices that you see or that you would advocate within companies to actually stop it being purely lip service and start being some good practical approaches?
Well, I think it's a good point. I think there's lots of courses out there now, and lots of people doing mental health training, mental health first aid training and things like that. So that's a good start. So if you've got somebody in your company that people can go to, they know that they can go to that person. I think that's important. And it's something people have to do now, whether they like it or not. You know, if one of your employees comes to you and mentions anxiety or depression and you don't do anything about it, and then further down the line something happens, then, you know, as an employer, you can be in big trouble with that. So, you know, I think it's really important that employers and you know, have things in place. The mental health first aiders are a good starting place. Maybe have some sort of counselling agency that you can refer people to. If you're not comfortable dealing with the situation yourself, then have something there that people can go, you know, they've got somebody private that they can go and talk to. You know, there's loads out there, you know, there's loads of different agencies you can use. So, yeah, it's really important. It's massive. You know, mental health now is massive. It's the thing, isn't it? I think it was a few years ago that it overtook skeletal problems, bad backs and things as the thing that people were more likely to be off work with. Right. You know, anxiety, depression, stress, all of those things. And there's no doubt it's on the rise, you know. Lots of different theories as to why.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, do you think it's because more people are having those computery office-based jobs, or do you think it's just more not as taboo to kind of talk about your mental vulnerabilities?
Yeah, I think it's definitely out in the open a bit more now. There's still a stigma to it, but it's definitely getting better. So more people are coming forward and talking about their mental health issues. It always makes me laugh when I go into schools, Anthony, because I talk to them and I say, look, I'm here to talk about mental health. And quite often the kids will go, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm not mental. I haven't got mental health. And I'm trying to explain to them that the way we've got physical health, we've got mental health as well. Everybody's got mental health, you know, and just as in the physical self, you know, you can be ill, you get a chest infection or you break a bone or something. Mental health's the same. You know, quite often people might go through a bout of anxiety or depression, but then get over it if they get the right help. So, you know, mental health and physical health go together. It's interesting now that psychiatrists, I was talking to a psychiatrist a while ago, and it was really interesting to hear her talk about the embodied self. And I thought, wow, so now and she was saying in psychiatry now they look at the whole body. They don't just, years ago, it was just the mind, and now they look at the whole body, you know, because it all goes together. So I thought that was really interesting, you know. The next part of the body with the most nerve endings after the brain is your gut. you know, so what are you doing about your gut? I always think if my gut could talk, sometimes it would go, what are you doing to me? What are you putting into me? So
yeah.
It's good that, you know, mental health is about the whole body. To me, it's not a separate thing. But yeah, I mean, I personally, I've got to be careful because we could spend hours on this. I just think the way the world is at the moment, and not just because of the COVID thing, I think that's had a massive impact on people's mental health, being locked away and not connecting with other people. I think that's, you know, that's been really important. Not giving people a choice. You know, when all this happened, I remember my mother-in-law, who very rarely goes out anyway, she doesn't really leave the house. She said, I'll be glad when this is all over and things get back to normal. And I was thinking, why? This is pretty normal for you. But then I got what she was saying. It's about having the choice. If she wanted to go out, she could go out. While all the COVID thing was on and lockdown, she couldn't. I also think social media plays a massive part in mental health. Absolutely massive, especially for young people. You know, they can be isolated, and you know, it's just, there's so much going on, Anthony, with social media. I've got to be careful that I don't go off on one, because I can see how, you know, it's so easy to manipulate people through social media. And yeah, it's only, and I think it's only going to get bigger. It's only going to get worse on all levels, you know, on all levels. You know, yeah, now if they want to, if somebody speaks out and, you know, society doesn't like it, they basically close off all their social media. You know? So you can't say anything on Twitter, Facebook, anything. You know, the days of going and dragging people out of their houses and beating them up like in the Chinese Revolution, they've all, you know, those days have thankfully gone. But now they'll just shut down all your social media platforms, and they can make, you know, they can make, I think it was Malcolm X who said, you know, the media have got the power to make the innocent look guilty and the guilty look innocent. And that's quite scary. So, you know, social media's got a lot. And again, it's how it's used. It's like I always say to people about knives, you know, you could give a surgeon a knife and he'll save your life. Give it to somebody who's mugging you and it'll potentially kill you. And it's the same with social media. It's a fantastic tool, but it's just how, you know, how people use it. So,
yeah. Yeah, I think I was talking to someone about vaccine passports, or the potential that we might have vaccine passports. And for me, I think it's a massive restriction on your human rights to have to carry something around with you. But then I know that, you know, all they have to do is put in the newspapers, you know, or you can't go on your summer holiday to Tenerife this year, and basically everyone's going to sign up. And we'd all think twice about it if it would limit your freedom of movement. But then someone said a really interesting point. It was this, I can't remember his name. There's like a Viking philosopher guy on YouTube. He's a bit controversial, but I like him. He like walks around in the middle of nowhere.
Is it Wim Hof?
No, it's Bjorn Andreas Bull-Hansen. That's his
name.
Okay. But he was saying, what happens if they turn off your vaccine passport? Or if you give all your information over to a central organization, they could turn you off. And that's what's happening with social media. You can be turned off as a person.
Yeah. Very powerful.
Yeah.
And I'd like to see the figures. I heard someone talk about it the other day. They were on about mental health in teenagers. But since social media's got so big, the mental health has shot up as well. And especially the guy I was listening to, he was talking about young teenage girls, how, you know, they can isolate each other. You know, say, for example, I heard of a girl recently, all her friends had a party and she wasn't invited. But, you know, then she's looking on social media and all her friends are having a great time and she's left out. And that's quite powerful, you know. It's, you know,
yeah. And yeah, it's the classic story of, you know, when I was a teenager, there wasn't, the only social media was like MySpace, but I never really used it because where I grew up, it was like dial-up internet and the internet was crap. But then, you know, as you get older or kids growing up nowadays, if you get dumped or you break up with someone, you can still see what they're doing or who they're hanging out with. And that mental trauma that used to be, you know, one and done, now is lingering on, and you can torture yourself, comparing yourself and stalking people, can't you?
Yeah, and it's out there. It can be out there forever, can't it?
Yeah.
So it's difficult, but I mean, I've sort of like I said, I've got to be careful, Anthony, because I go off on tangents. These are topics that I'm quite passionate about. But going back to what you were saying at work, I think it's important that people have these things in place. You know, you've got maybe a mental health first aider that people can talk to. You've got maybe posters up or where people telling people where they can go and get help. You know, so you're acknowledging, you know, because you don't know. It's one of those things with mental health. You can't see. If somebody breaks their arm, you can see they've got a broken arm, or if somebody's got flu or a chest infection, you can tell. But with mental health, you don't know, you know, and you don't know what's going on in people's lives that are working all around you.
And what's the implication for someone who's working from home at the moment? You know, are there tools where you can become more self-aware of your own mental health? Because I know that in the past, I've probably hit depression and anxiety and everything else, and not being honest with myself, that's what I was going through, or I just didn't know. I just thought that was the pain of, you know, being an entrepreneur and a hustler, if you like. You just getting up early and you're grinding, but then you realize, looking back, wow, I felt like shit, and I probably didn't have to do that to myself. So are there tools that you can gain that self-awareness so that you can go up to someone and tell them that you're not feeling great?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a good point, actually, because it can creep up on you. You know, the anxiety or it normally starts with stress, people getting stressed. And we get stressed because it's normally when we feel we can't deal with the situation. If you feel you can deal with the situation, you've got the skills to cope with that situation, it's not stressful. But if you feel, you know, it's starting to overwhelm you, I don't know if I can do this, you're doubting yourself, that's when you start to get stressed. And if you're not careful, that can turn into anxiety. And with anxiety, people are normally quite highly strung. And then you can come back down into depression then because you're burnt out, you know. And I'm talking about depression is really when you don't want to get out of bed in the morning. Not, you know, not just feeling low. It's, we all feel low from time to time, but It's a really good question about, yeah, I mean, there's lots of stuff online that you can do. There's the Wheel of Life that I quite like. I think you can download it or Google it, where, you know, you look at different areas of your life and score yourself. So, you know, say, for example, relationships. How are my relationships at the moment? It's out of 10, so you might score yourself a 5. It's stopping and looking at where you are, you know. Health-wise, how am I doing at the moment? You know, how's my health? So just a little tool like that, it just stops. Because like you say, you can be going through all this stuff and not even know that you're going through it, because it creeps up on you. And it's good as well if you've got people around you that you can have an honest conversation with, a partner or somebody saying, you know, somebody notices that, you know, you're not your normal self. You're starting to get a bit moody or a bit, you know, arguing with people and things like that. Or even just going, you know, going into your shell, becoming a bit reserved.
Yeah,
it's a good point. I mean, there are, I'm just trying to think where you could send people to that, because there are things like, you know, if I'm doing a lot of work for probation at the moment, the probation service, and they have you know, they'll ask a list of questions at the beginning, which some of them sound really, you know, a bit odd. Do you clean your teeth every day? Do you wash every day? And, you know, quite often people are going, well, of course I do. But if people are depressed, they don't. So, you know, how's your sleep patterns and things like that? Because quite often sleep is the first thing to go. If you're not sleeping very well, you know, what's going on there? And that's quite often because you can't switch off when you go to bed. So just watching for things like that, really. Off the top of my head, Anthony, I can't think of resources that people can go to. But
do you, you know,
it is about stopping.
It's like the Jordan Peterson quote of, you know, clean your room, isn't it? It's if you notice that things are going, you know, you're chucking all your clothes on the floor, you don't stop and caring about yourself, probably something's going wrong there. Do you ever use journaling or recommend journaling?
Massive. Journaling's brilliant. Even something like, you know, people struggle with, I set up a course a long time ago, me and a friend, two of us, we set up this course, and the biggest part of it was journaling. So what we would do is get people to keep a daily diary, Anthony. So, and we'd ask them, so every day they'd say, was today a good day or a bad day? What was good about it? What was bad about it? Score it from 1 to 10. What feelings came up? What could you do differently tomorrow? And the amount of resistance we got from people. People would pay to do this course, we'd give them the course. That's a big, you know, just mentioned Jordan Peterson. He does that self-authoring program. It's a lot of work. The amount of people that don't do it. So, but journaling's brilliant because you're getting it, you're getting all these, they reckon the average, this keeps changing. I first heard 50,000. Somebody told me recently it's 80,000. So the average person has between 50 and 80,000 thoughts a day, which is a lot. Most of it's subconscious. So if you can start getting those thoughts out and writing them on paper, definitely, yeah, definitely. Really powerful. Really, you know, I'm a big fan of journaling.
Yeah, me too. I got into it more of the Tony Robbins kind of a emotional side of it, like how am I feeling today? What's my intention for the day? Those sorts of things. And I find with a lot of self-development stuff that's really good, I'm not very consistent with it. It's like, you know, going to the gym or eating healthily. I'll go through little spurts of doing it.
Yeah,
but the one thing that I found to be really helpful and what I'm consistent with is tracking my rest and heart rate every morning and tracking my mood out of 10. And it gets something down on paper. And then I'm more likely to write down my intention. I always write down my key tasks that are going to help me move forward. And I'm a massive fan of brain dumps, you know, dump all the stress and all the tasks down. And, you know, if they're important, they'll get done. If they're not important, at least they're out of your head.
And
do it all the time.
There's so many different, you're right. And part of that is creating a habit, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, so you get up every morning and you do the same thing, whether it's meditate, or I'll meditate. I've got a little book, a spiritual book that I just read a page out of every day. It's only a small book. Then I'll meditate. Throughout the lockdown, I've started to learn French just on Duolingo, just 10 minutes a day. It's going to take me forever, but I just think if I learn one word a day, you know, so I've got in the habit now of doing 10 minutes. If you know, throughout the day, I might do a little bit more, but I'll make sure that in the morning I do that, meditate. I'm doing my Wim Hof breathing exercises now because it's supposed to be good for your immune system. Wim Hof cold showers, which every time I get in a cold shower, I think, why am I doing this? But again, it's supposed to be good for your immune system. So getting in a habit, getting in those habits and keeping them going, because quite often we get to a place and we think, I feel all right now, and we let them slip. And then, you know, you say to people, you know, what happened? You were doing really well. What did you keep this going? Oh, no, I stopped because I was okay. And the fact that actually that just shows you it's working. So keep going, you know. So and the journaling, I'd probably say to journal, it depends. Maybe do it at the end of the day. I'm a big believer in different parts of our personality as well. So, you know, for me, the fear bit, the self-doubt bit is the scared little kid inside me. It's the little Tony, you know, that's still there, and I know he's still there. So you could even do that. You've got to be careful with this, but you know, you could even write to that scared bit of your personality. You know, why is he scared? And you can have you can have some really powerful dialogues going between different parts of your personality. You know,
have you
it's quite powerful.
Have you read a book called The Monster Mind by Hazel Gale? She's a MMA athlete. I'll send you after. It's incredible. There were some exercises about she called it the little monster. And she found that before she'd go and get into the cage, it was like she'd be having such hard negative self-talk. You know, you're worthless. You're not going to win this. Even if you do win, it's a fluke. Yeah. It would be like a way of self-sabotaging. So if she did lose, I suppose, it wasn't unexpected. And if she did win, it was something outside of her control. And so she actually studied psychology, and now she's a therapist. And one of the things that she recommends in the book is draw your little monster, you know, what's holding you back, and then draw a speech bubble and write inside what that little monster's saying to you all the time. And mine was saying, I'm wasting my life. And then you start having a dialogue with the inner child and the little monster, and just that little exercise massively improved my outlook, because you start seeing it for what it is, as something that isn't really you. It, like you say, it's a part of your psyche.
Yeah. And by getting it down on paper, whether you draw it or whether you do the journaling, however you want to do it, you're making it tangible, aren't you? You can work with it. There's something, I've got something in front of me now that I can work with instead of it just being in my head and going over and all these thoughts clashing in my head. Yeah. Like I said, I mean, one of my favorite types of therapy is a thing called transactional analysis, where they talk about parent, adult, child, you know. Again, different. Most of us growing up would have had, in the parent bit, most of us growing up would have had more criticism than nurturing. You've got a critical parent and a nurturing parent. So that bit when you were saying there, Anthony, about wasting your life, that would come from the critical parent part of your personality, which is talking to the little boy, the little Anthony, telling him he's wasting his life. That's the emotional bit. And that's where, so it's almost like you have a clash between two different parts of your personality. You know, that critical parent and that emotional child are clashing, you know, and the emotional child's scared. So it's actually being more nurturing to yourself. And the A bit in the middle, the adult bit, is actually, you know, the adult can negotiate between the parent. It's the bit that's standing back and can see, actually, because you'll be, well, we all are, we're all our own biggest critic, you know. I can criticize myself far worse than anybody else. I don't need other people to tell me that I'm messing up, because I know that I'm doing it myself, you know, and I'm beating myself up inside for doing that. So it's about being more nurturing and nurturing that child and maybe giving it that part of us thing that it never had. It's quite powerful when people tap into it. They're wow, you know.
Yeah.
I've
been obsessed with sports psychology and physical fitness, you know, since I was 12, so, you know, over 20 years. And sometimes, even though you'll hear about the same concept 20 different ways, it's just one that jumps out at you, isn't it? If I can change direction just for a second, Tom, I noticed on your website you said that you were a firefighter. What caused you to change careers and go in terms of like mindset coaching and self-defense coaching? What was that
to
trigger for you?
Well, I think there was a few things there, Anthony. I think what happened in the fire service, what they came around, the government had came up with some scheme about, they'd done some research to people that were in prison for long sentences. And a lot of them make sense. A lot of them had started with petty crime as kids, you know, like maybe stealing or lighting fires and things like that. So they came up with this scheme, you know, if a young kid was caught lighting a fire or his parents were worried about him, you know, they'd caught him lighting a fire, the best person to go and talk to them would be a firefighter. So they asked for volunteers, and I was brought up on a really rough, they used to call it Dodge City, a big counselling estate. And a lot of the people that I grew up with had ended up, you know, going into the criminal world, really, and they were decent people. They'd just gone on a different path. And so when this scheme came out, I thought, well, you know, I want to give something back, so I volunteered to do it. And they sent us on a counselling course. It was quite funny. It was a 2-day counselling course. You know, we were quite naive. They said, "Oh, you're counsellors now. You can go and talk to these young kids." And I'd find myself sitting in people's houses, and some of the situations were horrendous. I'd end up talking to the parents more than the kids, but I felt out of my depth. So I studied in my own time and qualified as a therapist. It took about 3 years, but I got a real passion for it. Plus, you know, it's that old saying, isn't it? You know, you're only here once. And as much as I enjoyed being a firefighter for the first sort of 10, 11 years, I'd got to the point where I was just getting fed up with it. I could have gone for promotion, you know, I was earmarked for promotion, and I'd done some temporary promotions, but I didn't really want to go down that, you know. And like you said about, you know, leadership, if you're going to lead people, you've got to set an example, haven't you? So, you know, I'm stuck, you know, I felt that I was starting to get stuck in that job, and I'm telling people you can do whatever you want to do. So I felt that I had to do that myself, which was scary. My wife stopped speaking to me for a couple of weeks after I'd handed, because I was talking about it, and then I said, I've handed in my notice today. I don't think she really thought I was going to do it. But yeah, I did that, yeah. And what I did, I took a year sabbatical. And at the end of the year, they said, you know, without pay, they said, you've got to, you know, if you don't want to come back, put it in writing. So I wrote a letter out, my resignation letter, left it on the table for a couple of weeks, because I was too scared. Even when I put it in the letterbox, Anthony, I was thinking, what have I done? You know, because it was a steady job, sick pay, you know, holiday pay, doing, you know, the banter was really good. So it was a massive decision, but one that I don't regret. You know, I look back now and I think I had 17 years as a firefighter, you know, going into burning buildings, cutting people out of cars. And I've had, it's probably 17, 18 years now as a therapist, working with lots of different people, you know, from bereavement stuff, anxiety, depression. So lots of different, and for me, life's about experience. You know, try and get as many, I'm trying to get as many different experiences in as I can. There's still lots of places I'd like to go and lots of things that I'd like to do.
Yeah. So, what did you
do? That's how that decision came about.
I'm just digging now. What did you do before you were a firefighter? Or what was like your earliest experience of thinking that you might want to be a firefighter?
It's really interesting because, you know, pain's a big motivator. Quite often when things get really painful, that's when we decide I've got to do something about this. So when I left school, I actually did an apprenticeship as a pipe fitter welder. My dad got me an apprenticeship. He worked out, but I didn't even know what a pipe fitter welder was. But, you know, my dad would say to me, you know, as long as you get an apprenticeship, it doesn't matter. Get an apprenticeship in anything and you'll have a job for life. So I did this apprenticeship, a four-year apprenticeship, and it was in the time of a Margaret Thatcher, and there was lots of factories closing and stuff like that. So at the end of the 4 years, they laid off, it's the first time they'd ever done it, but they laid off all the apprentices. So after that, I just went, I ended up working in a brickyard making bricks, worked in a few different car factories. And I remember working, I did lots of different jobs, and I was working at Peugeot in Coventry on the track, just spot welding all day long. And I was just thinking, this is driving me crazy, you know. And I had two little kids, and my kids were really small at the time. And I'd go home, and I'd come home from work, and I couldn't talk. It'd take me an hour or so to unwind from just doing the same job day in, day out. And then, because the car factory was doing really well, they brought a night shift out. So they were saying, right, you've got to do a month of days and a month of nights. And I remember thinking, this is hardly bearable on day, and I've got to do a month of nights of this as well. So I'll be working all night, going home, going to bed, not really seeing my wife or kids, getting up and going back to work again. And I remember sitting in the canteen one day. I used to sit with all the older guys. I mean, I'm probably about 26 now, but I'm sitting with all the older guys, and I heard them say, one of them said, if I had my time again, I wouldn't be in this car factory. And I just felt like screaming. And I just thought, I had a vision of me sitting there at the same age as these guys at 60, saying to some young lad coming into the car factory, if I had my time again. And I don't know where the firefighter came from, Anthony. I don't know whether I saw a fire engine driving down the road and I thought, do you know what? I wouldn't mind doing that. So I looked into it. And then a few months later, there was an advert in the local paper for firefighters. And I sent in for an application form. I think in them days, no, you had to go to the fire station and get an application form on a certain day. And the queue, I've never seen a queue like it in my life of people all the way down one of these main roads in Coventry. And I just joined the queue, got to the front. I think they gave you a basic eye test and then they gave you an application form. And they said only four out of every 100 people who apply get in, because it was quite a popular job. And I just remember thinking, I don't care what I have to do, I'm going to be in that four. Because I hated the working in the factory so much, I just wanted to get out of it. And it was about a two-year process from the time you applied, you know, to go and do. I went to WH Smith's because my maths was really bad. I brought a little kiddies maths book that said, this is a circle, cut it in half, you've got two halves, cut it in four, you've got four quarters. So I basically started again. And made sure that I was super fit, you know, and got into the fire service, which was a life-changing thing for me. Loved it, you know, loved it for quite a while, but then I just thought it was time to change. So, yeah.
It's awesome.
But again, if I'm being honest, that pain was the motivator, that pain of spending the rest of my life. And no disrespect to anybody that does it, you know, a job's a job. Some people there loved it. I'd say the majority of people hated it. You know, they couldn't stand their job, and it was, you know, 40 hours a week out of your life is a long time to do something that you really don't like. So yeah, you know, pain's my motivator. It was then anyway. It's like somebody said to me once, it's like you're sitting on a rusty nail, but it's not sharp enough. When it starts to stick in your backside, that's when you go, right, I'm going to do something now. So that was my motivation.
Oh, thanks for sharing that, Tony. That was awesome. I'm really interested in people's journeys because I read a lot about, you know, Joseph Campbell and the hero's journey, and you leave home and you're challenged and you have your own personal trials, and then you actually end up coming right back around to where you started and the teaching and passing on the gift that you've learned on your journey. And I used to think it was crap when I was younger, but then you actually find yourself, oh, actually, I'm at that stage of the hero's journey, and just knowing that makes life a bit more bearable and a bit easier to know that something better is coming, or to realize that everyone does have a gift. You know, it sounds cliche, but everyone does have advice and experience that they can pass on to other people. And I'm sure everything that you picked up,
Definitely.
you know, as a firefighter has benefited you as a counselor, because it's like you've had real world experience and now you can listen and question other people based on everything that you've been through in your life.
Definitely, yeah, 100%. And I think it's like you said, you quoted Jordan Peterson earlier, and I love Jordan Peterson. But he says about, you know, sometimes the reason making big decisions like that is so hard is because you're stepping into the unknown. You know, the fire, after 17 years in the fire service, I knew it. You know, I knew the job inside out. And like I said, you know, I was earmarked for promotion. And, you know, leaving that and stepping into the unknown, like he says, it's stepping into the chaos is quite scary. You know, and it is scary. And I think that's where people go wrong, because they think, you know, you make a big decision, you do something, and you wobble. But I always say to people, you know, part that wobbling is part of the process. You will wobble, you will doubt whether you've done the right thing or not, but it's sticking with it. You know, I've got this deep-seated belief, Anthony, that I think I've had for a long time, that I'll always be all right. But it doesn't mean that I don't wobble. But I just know that, you know, when things get hard, something always comes along. You know, just trust in the process. Keep putting yourself out there, keep going forward, and something always comes.
Yeah.
Think human beings, we're adaptable, aren't we? People always say about Charles Darwin that he said the strongest survive, but what he actually said is the species that's most adaptable will survive. And as human beings, we're really adaptable. We adapt, and we're good at it.
Do you find your philosophy? Well, I'm not going to ask this question, it's too leading. What's your philosophy on getting people to know that they can adapt and they can challenge themselves?
Well, part of the thing that I do with people, I love meeting people and talking to people and finding out their strengths that they and seeing they might not see it. So one of the things I always say to people is write down some of, for example, a simple exercise, write down some of your achievements. You know, and it could be something simple like, I don't know, passing a driving test, or, you know, getting out of bed in the morning might be an achievement for somebody. And then, okay, so write down maybe six things that you've achieved. What qualities did you need to do that? You know, like say for passing a driving test, you need to turn up all the time. You need to have a certain level of intelligence. You need to be consistent. So, you know, these are all qualities that people have got that they don't even realize that they've got. And then, so then it's drawing out people's different strengths. So then when you go forward, you've got, you know what your strengths are, you know, maybe even what some of your weaknesses are. So, you know, you're not going into that chaos unarmed, you know. So, you know, that's one of the things I would get people to do, see their own strengths. And that, you know, everyone's different. You know, I've got a deep-seated, like I said, I've got a deep-seated faith that I'll be all right. I remember my daughter, she likes to travel. She's a teacher in London now, but I think she'll be off again soon because she just loves traveling. And I remember the first time she went to Tanzania, and she was obviously having a bit of a wobble before she went. And she said, "Dad, what if I don't like it? We'll get on a plane and come back." And she was like, "Oh, okay." you know, and it sometimes it is that we make things really complicated. You know, you don't like it, give it a go. If you don't like it, come home, you can go somewhere else. Get yourself back together and go somewhere else. It's not that hard.
You mentioned strengths and weaknesses in terms of people's, let's say, skills at work. As I've got older, I've realized that rather than work on my weaknesses, which is what I always thought I had to do to be a perfectionist, which is a, you know, a downfall in and of itself, I realized that I can actually start collaborating with people who are good at what I'm not good at, like with the company that I'm running now, Lead Lifestyle. I like doing public speaking and networking and talking, and my business partner, that's like his worst nightmare, but he loves customer service and operations and making sure all the clients are really satisfied with what we're doing, and I hate that stuff. So it's, you know, it's interesting to collaborate. But do you think people are best suited to focus on their strengths, or do you think you can learn by improving your weaknesses?
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, people have often got more strengths than they realise. I look at people, I think it's very, I'd probably say it's always 99% of people I meet, and to think, wow, you don't realise how good you are and what skills and what strengths you've got. Like you said, I think, and part of it, we talk about negative bias, don't we? Negativity bias. And the theory, again, is that comes back from cavemen, cavewomen days, where life was so dangerous. And it would have been, you know, you probably lived in a tree and all around you was jungle and forest and stuff. And every time you stepped out, you know, you don't know what's in that forest or what's in that jungle. So our brains are geared, this is one of the theories, our brains are geared to focus on negativity because it's a threat. You know, and I found that when I was delivering courses to people, I might have 20 people on a course, for example, in the NHS, 18, 19 of them go, that was a really good course. I really enjoyed it. One would say, I didn't like it. And I'd find myself homing in on the one who didn't like it. And I was thinking, if that was someone else, I'd be saying, but 19 people have just said they loved it. Why are you focusing on the one? And it's that negativity bias, because the 19 people who like it and like me are not a threat. But the one person who didn't like it is a potential threat, even though logically I know they're not. So we home in on that negativity, and we do that, you know, and that, I think that's something to be really mindful of. You know, like you said, we are drawn towards our weaknesses rather than our strengths.
So, you know, talking of threats, and perhaps this could be the last section before we round it up, you do a lot of work with self-defense and I imagine coaching the mindset and linking that in with people's confidence and handling different situations so that you have a bit of skill in managing conflict. Do you think that becoming more skilled physically, even though you're not going to actually, you know, go out and you know, start punching people who are threatening you, do you think it gives you a calmness or a benefit mentally to be trained in martial arts?
Yeah, well, it did for me. If I'm honest, again, the reason I got into martial arts is because I was scared. You know, I was scared of physical confrontation, even though I'd had quite a bit of it growing up. I was always scared. And I thought, well, if I can get a black belt in anything, I won't be scared anymore. And then I got my first black belt in Shotokan karate and didn't feel any different. I just had a black belt around my waist now, and I was still scared. So I went and got another black belt and then another black belt, you know. But it definitely... I've realised what that's done for me, Anthony. I don't know if this will answer your question. Is that the more skilled I became, the less and less I wanted any conflict in my life. The chances of me having conflict are so slim. You know, I'd do anything to avoid it. I'm quite happy to just, you know, eat humble pie, whatever I have to do to, you know, to avoid conflict. But yeah, I think you're right. That comes from a confidence. You know, because I know that if I had to be physical, I could be physical, but I just don't want to be physical. I don't. Whereas when I was younger and I was scared, I think I would be more likely to be physical because I was scared and I felt like I had to prove myself. Whereas now, I don't think I have to prove anything. You know, I don't. The thought of conflict actually pretty much appalls me, to be honest. So I think there is something in that. And I don't know if that's primal as well. talking to a guy the other day, and he said he wanted to do it, you know. And I get a lot of guys coming to see, they want to have a white collar fight, or they want to do MMA, or, you know, and part of me is thinking, now it's not, it won't make much difference to you, to be honest. You know, your self worth, I guess it's all down to self worth and what we attach our self worth to. You know, working with professional boxers, they lose a fight, Anthony, and they go to pieces. So I'm working on them saying, you know, boxing is something that you do. It's not who you are. It's not you as a person. It's just something that you do. You know, I know it's a big part of your life. And it's the same with the physical stuff. I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, for me, I've learned, again, this might sound cheesy, but am I making my decisions from a fearful place or a loving place? You know, and that's something that I often ask myself if I've got a decision to make. Am I making this out of fear, or am I making it out of love? And then, you know.
So what sort of things and how do you teach that on your courses or your coaching with self-defense?
Well, what I've done recently with the courses that I've been putting together is that we do some quite tough physical exercises, partly because it brings the whole group together. So they're going through all these exercises together. You know, you might say 12 people on a course. You bring that, because they're all going through the same stuff, it brings them all together. Plus, I've found that when people get tired, they've got rid of all the adrenaline and they're more open to talking. So then we can go into the psychological side and start talking about fears. And, you know, anxiety is just another word for fear. So it works. It works. It's really powerful in, you know, in that way. So that's how I tend to use the self-defense stuff. I mean, and again, you know, whether we like it or not, there is a place for self-defense stuff. There are people out there that, you know, might try and mug you or attack you. I just think it's a lot less than people think. But, you know, there are some bad people in the world.
Yeah, I've done a bit of jiu-jitsu, you know, on and off for a few years. You know, didn't get to blue belt, so still like a beginner, massive beginner. But you learn enough to realize that you never want to get into a fight, because if you meet someone who knows how to fight, it's dangerous.
Yeah.
Really dangerous.
It is dangerous. And dangerous on lots of levels as well. Even if you hurt somebody, you know, you're in trouble then. Is it good self-defense to be sitting in a police cell, you know, over an, in, you know, somebody cutting you up in the car or spilling your beer or something like that? It's just not, it's not worth it.
I think for me, it was interesting because I'd gone to a good level in rugby, and I, you know, big, strong guy, went to do jiu-jitsu, and small girls and small guys were destroying me. And and you expect to be good when you're, you know, a decent athlete. You just expect to be good. You got that confidence. But it was brilliant because I knew that was what jiu-jitsu did for people. I'd heard about it, Joe Rogan, other, you know, celebrities talking about the benefits of jiu-jitsu. So I wanted to do it to have that kind of ego battering, and it's immediate, but it's brilliant because that's, you realize that by failing that and, you know, tapping out is, you know, basically I want to learn how you did that. And then people are open to teaching that. And that's a brilliant philosophy for leadership as well. I think if we can bring it back to the kind of message that I want to bring is if leaders can admit when they failed, that's when everyone's going to start learning, isn't it?
Definitely, yeah. I love that honesty, you know, and just that we all make mistakes. And just because you're a leader, it doesn't mean you don't make mistakes. And it doesn't mean that you haven't got your own fears and hang-ups and things like that. It just means you're a human being, you know. And, you know, you might be good at leading people, and but you're still going to have your faults. So, and I really like that. You know, I really admire that honesty, instead of people putting on a front that most of the time you can see through it anyway. I like that congruence with people, you know. For me, that's massive. That's so important. You know. Going back to being a fireman, you know, I had lots of different, you know, leaders, officers in charge, and the best ones were the ones that they were really good at building a rapport, you know, so that you wanted to help them. The worst ones were the ones that were just so by the book, and you'd ask them something and it was like, because that's the way it is, and there was no give, no, you know. I just think for me, life's all about relationships. The same in therapy. It's they say, which I really like, it's the relationship that heals, you know, and it does. If you can build a good relationship with people, then, you know, that for me, that's being a leader. And people will do what you want them to do because they respect you. But again, you know, for me, that's about being honest.
Yeah, I think that's a, being honest is probably a good way to round it up, Tony, and leave it there. Thanks for coming on, mate. And it's been a bit eclectic. I've enjoyed it. But where can people find more about you and what you do?
Well, they can go on my website, tonysummers.com. Or I'm on Facebook. I've got an Embrace Your Fears page on Facebook where people go on and they just put motivational quotes and things like that. So if anybody wants to join that, that they can find out there. Or give me a call. Telephone number is 07708273376 or tony@tonysummers.com.
Awesome. Thanks, Tony. Well, thanks for coming on. And there's loads to go through. I'll make sure that I send that that Monster Mind Solution book over. And yeah, brilliant. I really enjoyed it, mate. We should do another one.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Thanks, mate. And take care.
And you. Thanks, Anthony.
Bye.
Bye-bye.